Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for visual artists. The Clark Hewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding to working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Sabin Howard. Sabin is a classical figurative sculptor known for his works of heroic scale, including Hermes, Aphrodite, and Apollo. In the New Criterion, he's been called a sculptor whose work radiates a startling presence while finding its roots in the classical past. He's part of the winning design team for the National World War I Memorial in Pershing Square Park, Washington, D.C., and he also offers drawing and design webinars in a digital format. Sabin, welcome to the show. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and what you do for a living?
Thank you. I sculpt from live models in the studio, which is New York City. I've been doing this for 33 years. I was a teacher for 20 years at the graduate level, moved into a full-time sculpture business about 15 years ago. And currently, well, the last year has been spent designing the sculptural component of the World War I Memorial, which is a 75-foot-long bronze wall that represents World War I. That has 45 figures in a processional composition. So that's where I'm headed, more towards public art, and I'm coming off about 20 years of doing art that's been more for people's private residences. And the future is more about how do you make this art have a platform that can be seen by everybody and taken seriously.
Why this move? Why public art? Why private art? It seems like a twin paradox.
Well, I came into, you know, art at 19 years of age, and both my parents are PhDs and academics. So I thought, okay, let's take the standard road, which was a lot of artists get into teaching. So that's how I started. And then from that kind of people around me and that kind of environment, really the gallery system was what was the economic supportive thing that could allow me to do my art and be creative and not have to like do somebody else's idea of what the art should be about. So I moved into it. And I'm saying this from an academic point of view, like the first 20 years of my career were really spent learning how to sculpt a classical figure in a nude, which is the traditional way. So I really studied the Greeks. I studied Michelangelo. I studied Rodin, with the concept of like playing it forward. And so that's not the kind of stuff you see out in public, especially in this country. There's no place in people's hard drive for nude art in public. And so I was working, doing my own thing, let's say, and that's how my art got collected by patrons that would then buy the work and put it in their living room or their garden. And after 20 years of doing this and realizing, okay, this is great. I am doing really well doing this, but I'm never going to break through to the next level. And so how do you do that? I really gave it some thought, and I entered into the competition last year for the World War I Memorial in Washington. And I didn't get accepted into the top tier right away, but then I got circled back in by another team that came back to me and brought me in to that team, and then we became the winning team. And so that's what happened.
Well, let me ask you about that. So why specifically the modern classical tradition, and is that even an accurate term?
Yeah, it is. I want to give this some thought. I really see myself as a modern classicist. Okay, so there are two things here. Let me just speak a little bit about where I'm coming from. All right, I grew up in the 60s in New York City. It's a time where you really are thinking outside the box. Vietnam War, my parents are big anti-government, anti-follow the herd, think outside the box. And so I'm dealing with that on one side. And then my mother is Italian. So I go back to Italy with my parents, you know, 3 months old. And I end up in Italy for 3 years. So I'm three. So it's this combination. The combination is tradition, which is that visual beauty that you see in Europe. That's what I'm surrounded by as a kid. And then I'm coming back into New York, and you're surrounded by this massive revolution, social revolution. Think for yourself. Follow your passion. Follow your dreams. And so the combination of those two things has made me who I am today. I'm not following the standard or the norm to make figurative art. I really believe that you have to, okay, learn their technique, you learn your structure, and then once you've got that, well, you know, in your subconscious thought process, so you're not thinking, well, you are thinking, but how to do it, but it's not like a stumbling block, then your individual vision from, I guess, your, you know, the whole concept of human condition comes out. What is your personal take on the human condition? So that's the modern part. That's the part that's the artist, where you're the individual. And the classical part is a vocabulary that is universally understood. It's understood by people that are not in art, people that are in art. And so you're speaking, it's like, if you want to read a book, you need to know how to read. You need to know how to do that. It's a simple function. And so it's not gibberish. So you have to have the tools, the technique first, and then you have to have something that everybody can understand. And lastly, that gives you an ability to speak your own individual vision of what it means to be a human being as an artist.
Well, let's ask about specifically then the World War I Memorial. So you said you entered, you didn't expect to win. How did you win, do you think? What was the deciding factor?
Oh, this is really wild, because it's like I came into it from the back door in a way. I entered with Michael Imber, who's like this classical, world-renowned architect out of San Antonio. So we came into the project. We started this in the summer last year, not this summer, the previous summer. Submitted in August, and we didn't move into the shortlist with five people. So I got this email in September 15th, from Joe Weishard. It's a very polite email, urging me to join his team. And Joe is a 26-year-old architect who had made the top five shortlist. He'd gone to the first meeting in this shortlist group, and the commission had said, well, it looks like you have some sculpture here that you want to do. And what he did, he Googled, okay, classical sculptors, and he Googled that. And what comes up is like St. Gaudens. So he looks up St. Gaudens. I don't know if people know, but St. Gaudens lived 100 years ago, and he's dead now. So he found out that most of the classical sculptors are dead out there. And then he went to National Sculpture Society and went through the list, and he went through over 200 names, and my name was reversed. So it was under S rather than Howard. And when he got to Sabin, he threw out his list, and he wrote me an email, and I called him that night, and I was like, yeah, I'd be delighted to be on your team. When we went through the process then last fall of the interviews, I listened to what the commission asked of me. This is something that's also really, really important, that's changed for myself and my process over the years. My art is not only about me doing my thing in the studio. It's about also several things. It's in service of playing forward the amazing tradition of the past and playing it forward, not recreating it, playing it forward in my own way. And so I'm in service of that. And I'm also in service of making art that brings people a sort of transformation that's visceral when they see it in public. And that's the new element that I really yearn for that. You know, it's like I sell a piece to one person, he puts it in his living room. What, 12 people see it, his family members and maybe the people that come over to his home? It's not visible. It doesn't have a huge impact. It doesn't have the ability to have a revolutionary change of the art world. And that's something that I really wish to do, kind of redirect the way art has been going.
So what made you specifically, what was the trigger point at which you decided, I'm going to apply for this commission? It seems like, you know, it's a real pivot. It, you know, you sort of you generalized a little bit and it was sort of like, I know I'm not going to break out with what I'm doing, but that's a huge pivot to go from that to I want to do the World War I Memorial in D.C.
Well, it's kind of, you know, stuff doesn't happen overnight. You know, things grow inside your head. I got on the list. Frank Gehry called me for the Eisenhower Memorial. I was on a short list on that. I went out to see him, and Frank Gehry said, okay, you're the sculptor for the Eisenhower Memorial. And then for some reason, 3 months later, I got a call and it's like, no, we moved on to somebody else. It's not a good fit for us, which I would agree. So then that was in my head, and this is the previous summer. So then I got the email. Well, just having a taste of that, okay, think about it. All right, I'm going to make a sculpture here, and a lot of people are going to see it, and I'm going to be able to make large sculptures. And there's another component here. I'm going to be paid well to do that, and so I'm going to have the time in the studio, the ability to spend the correct amount of time to bring the art to a really high level. So that's really important to me. So I've been funding my own art up to now through my art sales, and then, you know, you got to hustle to make X amount to pay for the models, you pay for the sculpture, the casting, the mold making. The process costs are high, and then the studio rent. So this is all being funded up to that point through my own sculpture business. So then if you move into public art, you are not thinking so much about that as much as, okay, the money's already coming in, and it sets up a sustainable system. And then if that's out of the way in your mind, then more attention can go to making the art at a really high level, which in my formula is time, and then having the funds or the finances there to be able to pull that off.
Let's talk about that for a little bit. So when you're working on such a large piece, do you continue to budget time for other works to maintain your practice?
Well, look, this is also the first time I've gone into something so large, so I haven't been able to do anything but this. And I'm unable to do other projects because this is 65 hours a week of full-on creativity. I mean, we're talking here 6 days a week, 10 to 12-hour days of pure creative, like right now it's been designing, drawing, composing with models. And that brought me to a higher level artistically and creatively. And so, to be blunt, it's made me wildly creative, because that's all you think and breathe and eat. You're going to get better if that's where all your attention is going, all your thought process is going there.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So how long do you expect this commission to last? How long is it going to take you to create it?
We're in design process. We'll be in design process with the government agencies probably into February. It could be longer. I don't know, because we had a really good meeting and we passed forward to the next stage. So then I start sometime next year, and then they accept the design, which is the 75-foot long wall. It could be 6 years. It depends on what they say. And then I'll make the adjustments on my end by hiring more sculptors and setting up shifts in my studio so that there are two shifts of sculptors, 2 to 3 people sculpting each 8 to 10 hours. So that's 16 to 20 hours of sculpture rather than just me making the sculpture. So I'm going to do a lot more, I guess, admin work, and then correcting what the assistants are doing. That's also a new phase.
So then I'm just, you know, curious about how you negotiated the contract. Was it difficult? Did you have to get an attorney involved? Were there stipulations that, you went back and forth over?
Yeah, I don't want to get into the specifics. I'm working with a pretty fair team here. The commission's pretty fair. I think that they know that they've hired somebody with a skill and a talent, and that you sit down and you go through things, and it's common sense to have somebody look over your contract.
Well, that's good. See, we're talking to participants in our accelerator program, fellows in the program, about legal issues ranging from copyright to sort of negotiating contracts with everyone from gallerists to museums to, other large public commissions.
Okay.
And they have lots of questions on their mind, and we don't get to pick the brain of anybody really very often that has done this successfully and feels comfortable with what they've achieved. So that's the basis of me asking. It isn't really, give us the dirt.
Let me come back to that then. I'm going to talk about stuff that I've been doing for the last 20 years. I don't want to discuss World War I contracts so much, but I will discuss my contracts because I've done, you know, many contracts with clients for commissions, and it's the same format. Okay, so I'd have a meeting with a client for a sculpture, a life-size piece that would go into their garden or living room. Right, so I would write out a contract that would stipulate when I would be paid, how much I would be paid, when I would deliver, what my time frame was, what my casting costs were, and then here's the thing that I got really lucky on. A lot of my clients are lawyers, so they set me up with kind of a formula on how you deal with that. So then when I would set up a contract, I did not come into this like, oh yeah, I'm really good at this. It's like a lot of, you know, trial and error stuff where you make a mistake and then the next one you do better. I think artists need to kind of like plan out and structure, and you structure, there are three things that you do. You structure your time. How much does what's my monthly budget? And that includes your studio, your living costs. And then you've got to factor in also your taxes, your tax costs. And then the last is obvious. It's like the process costs. How much are your process costs? For a sculptor, you got models. You have foundry costs. This is the bronze casting, the mold to get to the bronze. And then you have your delivery costs and your installation costs and your base for the sculpture. And so then you come up, you have to know how much that stuff costs. And then that's how you come up with a number. But at the end of the day, it's like, how much money do you need per month to do your life the way that you do your life? And that's individual to each person's, you know, economic needs.
Right. So
does that answer?
Yeah, I think it does. Well, you know, I think working artists have lots of questions about this, but I'm sure they're excited about that that answer. Yes. So let me ask you about collaboration. You've been working on a collaborative team with an architect. What's that like? Tell us more.
He's not Joe Weishar, the architect. It's less collaborative with him. It's been extremely collaborative with the commission. And this is a completely new process for me, which I was not used to because I'm used to dictating all the terms. Like, there's very little collaboration for figurative private sculpture. It's like, okay, what do you think, Sabin? What should we do? And then I would give an idea and then get to it. Okay, but this is a real different system because I'm working with an internal group, not the government agency, the World War I Commission. So they have a lot of ideas about how the sculpture should go. And then they're also coming to it with, like, I'm coming to the process not having any knowledge of collaboration. And they're coming to the process with having very little knowledge about actual art. So we had to have several meetings, you know, and they would say things and I would be like, oh geez, here we go again, and being very open because I said this to them. But every time I walked away from the critiques that I'm given that I didn't like, I elevated the process of the composition of these 40 figures to a higher level, and so it became more cohesive in the design. So it got, it could be more easily read by the general public. It became more exciting in the drama and the emotion. So their feedback kind of drove me to the next level, and then I had to be able to rip everything up and rebuild. And I think that takes a lot. And now I've gotten used to it now because it's 6 months in. But it's something that I didn't welcome, and now it's like, wow. The piece that I've created now is much higher than I would have done if I'd only been using my own mind without other people's input.
Let's dig into a little side trail. So speaking of other people's input, I mean, you also do drawings. Sculpture is not your only art. And in fact, you turn your drawings into limited edition prints. It seems like almost everything you create, in fact, you know, becomes a money-making venture. I'll be asking you about the education side of things in a little bit. But Is that accurate? Is, you strike me as you know you're in business. You think of this as a business. Is that wrong?
Yeah, this is a business. I want to say though that everything comes with an integrity or a passion for my art. And if I didn't have, I'm going to call art my product. If I didn't have a really, really high end product, and I hadn't spent 50,000 hours in front of a model over 33 years, no shortcuts. That's what I'm telling. That's what I'm saying. No shortcuts in learning my craft. I wouldn't have a business. And I learned that with a business, I can have a more independence to be more creative. And I didn't come into this at all with that way of thinking, because both my parents being academics, they don't teach you that as parents. They teach you as, let's go to school and become a teacher. And I don't mean to be derogatory, but as a teacher, you are receiving a paycheck. So you are receiving your medical insurance from a structure. As an independent artist, you are doing that on your own. You wake up every day, you have to decide how to create your own life. So there is a creative aspect to entrepreneurship and business that I really wish more artists could see that. And I think they don't see it till they get a little bit older and they have children and families and the bills go up. And I think that's the death of a lot of artists, that they leave the career for the paycheck. And I just can't do that. I never could do it. I would go homeless before I did that, because I have no choice. And I call art is like my disease. I live and breathe this. If I don't make art, I just don't function as a human being. I have to do it. And so I have to do the business to drive the art. And I don't like to use the word necessary evil, because there's actually a lot of really cool stuff about running a business because of the independence. But I have to say this, there are no shortcuts, and you make mistakes and you have to rectify them and you have to keep moving forward. I want to stress there's a creative element to business that is crucial. You have to kind of rip it up, just like the collaboration thing. You rip it up and you start over. And you, if it doesn't work, you start over something else.
Well, it's not just, you know, art even. You're also a rock climber. And, you know, I'm curious about that too. Do you bring, you know, sort of that athleticism and that focus from that sport into your studio practice in some way?
Yeah. Well, look, I stopped climbing because the art has just took over, and climbing is an addictive sport. But I learned so much from climbing that I brought into the art. And it was with climbing, rock climbing, I traveled out west all over, did traditional climbing with gear. And there's this thing called, in climbing, it's called on-site, where you do a route on a climbing wall, and it's the first time you've done it. You don't have any data or info on it, except, you know, what's in the guidebook, maybe. And that word on-site is really key, because I make an analogy between climbing and life. Life is on-site. So you strategize in the climb. You hit fear. You got to deal with fear. Fear is what blocks people from going forward. Fear is what kills people in climbing. If you don't deal with your fear, you don't get to the top. Okay. So in my life, the fear factor is always there. So how do you deal with it? You learn to deal with fear, dial it down. And it's a lot of, I guess you could call it mind games, because it doesn't kill you. It only makes you stronger. But why am I saying this? Because rock climbing and life are both dependent on where your mind is at. So either you govern your mind, or you let external elements govern your mind. And that's kind of the deal that you have been given as a human being.
I want to turn to our audience now and just say the Clark Healings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing now, a gift of $15 per month would be welcome and an appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Sabin, I want to turn for a moment to sort of the marketing and PR side of your art practice. So do you work with any galleries?
No, not I don't anymore.
Then how do you sell work without the support of a gallery? Outside, of course, you know, the current project aside.
I have two sides to me. I'm very introverted because I go to the studio all the time and I work on my art. But I'm also, if I'm around people, I have social abilities to just share my work and share myself with them. So there's a sense of, even from when came out of of college and I was like 2 years in two years into art school, I went around with a sheet of slides to share with people. So it's always sharing the work with everybody that I meet. And I guess I travel in good circles that on people that are interested in culture. So it's I'm always showing my work. And it gets more complicated, but it's not only about me. I like to bring joy to other people through my art. So the word narcissism comes up to me. It's not that. It's not only about me showing my work to somebody else. It's also making a connection, an energetic connection with other people. So I'm talking about my mindset. What's my mindset when I show somebody my work? I'm not thinking, okay, I can sell this piece to that person. No, I'm actually thinking, oh, maybe they would be interested in this type of art and we can have a good conversation. Sometimes it goes to the next level and they say, oh, can I come to the studio? And then the door opens, but it's like my doors are always open. The studio doors are open. My images are on my cell phone. I have a website. I get emails from people. I respond to the emails. You never know what's coming.
Well, so you've stated in multiple interviews, Huffington Post, the Atlas Society, that you don't really believe in the gallery system. Why is that?
There's a problem with it, especially what's happened with the economy. The percentages, if they are 50-50, don't function for either side, and especially for a sculptor because their process costs are so high. So if the gallerist has an astronomical rent to meet every month, he needs to sell a lot of art, so then he's going to have a stable of artists. That stable of artists are not receiving 100% of his attention all the time. He has to see who he can sell, so he might spend more time with one of those artists' work than someone who's not selling so well. So who has the art's best interest? It's the person that made that art. And I think it's really important that an artist be involved in showing their work and feeling more empowered in that he takes ownership, that that's what he makes and that's what he needs to sell to other people rather than have somebody else take over his business. So I think you got to start thinking about it if you haven't done it before and making steps towards it. And you can, the beauty of this country is there are so many organizations and so many books that you can read and start to learn about how to do that kind of stuff. So the gallery system did function at once, but it doesn't anymore because a gallerist would encourage and push artists, you know, through the sales. But I think because it's a small business, especially like in a place like New York, if the rent's like $28,000 or $35,000 a month, that's an awful lot of art that gallerist has to sell. And so it doesn't work.
So, you know, you started your own gallery also briefly in Chelsea, which for those who don't know is a neighborhood in New York. And it was very brief. It was about 7 months. But can you tell us more about that experience and why you did it?
It was hard. I had worked on a bronze, which was the final result of Apollo. And I spent 3,400 hours with two models over 2.5 years making that life-size standing male nude. And prior to that, I'd done two other pieces that were initial studies that to get to that final piece. So overall, I was looking at almost 5 to 6 years of creative process to do this Apollo sculpture. And it was something that was really important to me because I was enamored with the work of the Renaissance and what is the work of the Renaissance in terms of sculpture? It's the male nude. So I was following in that path and playing it forward, like I said, and I was also like learning my craft, like I was talking about before. And so here I have this sculpture and I didn't want to like just stick it in a gallery and then give it away. So I got a really highly visible corner in New York City that had like 2,200 square feet and 15-foot high ceilings through a trade of one of my bronzes to one of my collectors. And then I got another friend who's a contractor and set up all this lighting, and the walls, since it was a corner gallery, were all glass, and it could be seen from 2-3 blocks away because everything's glass and you had this amazing lighting that set it off. And so I did this unveiling there, and it was pretty, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about it, but then it's very strange because some of the things that happened because I did that led to the World War I commission. So it didn't, why am I saying this? What happened was there were things that I would never have thought were going anywhere that happened in that period, somebody walking in and then passing the word on to somebody else that put me in front of Frank Gehry. And then being in front of Frank Gehry got the gears thinking, okay, this is kind of interesting. I want to do work that everybody in the United States is going to see. And then the World War I commission comes and I'm like, I'm going to apply for this. I never would have done that if I hadn't had that gallery. That's one thing. The other thing is I learned how to talk to clients or people that were interested in my work in a really direct elevator pitch type way that was full of integrity and honesty and passion, because I had to do it every day when people walked into my gallery and asked, whose work is this? And I say, I'm the artist. How can I help you? And then they look at me like, this is weird. An artist is like greeting us at the door. He owns the gallery. It's just kind of like something does not compute here.
So do you market your work? Again, not referring to the current project, but do you do marketing? And if so, how?
Yeah, I do a lot of emails. I do a lot of, I don't like the word marketing because it has like a kind of like a cheaper way of looking at it. I do a lot of interactive work where I set up relationships with people. Yes. And it goes via email with images, and it goes with meetings and showing the books that I have on my work. And it goes with studio visits. And I also take a lot of images of the work and share that. And I think we're really, really blessed in this day and age with the computer. And you can just like put a visual image in somebody's living room privately by sending them an email and with some kind words. And they can open that whenever they have a moment and they feel like it at night, and they might see an image that might blow them away. But that's the positive. The negative of all this is that people get so many images that they don't pay attention anymore. But you have to try.
Well, let me ask you. You said, I don't like marketing. And, you know, you said, oh, it's like a dirty word. And, you know, you're not the only one saying that. This is a very common comment that artists make. Do you think that this instinctive recoiling from calling it marketing, treating it as a business, do you think that that's costly for artists, that it keeps them poor?
Yes, I do. I think because you're an artist, so you're not thinking about that. That's not what you want to do. First, you don't want to do that. That's not your greatest skill. Otherwise, you wouldn't be an artist. Your greatest skill is your craft. But you got to learn how to present yourself. So I don't have anything against the actual, if you looked up the definition of what marketing is. I just don't like using that word because so many people are pitching junk. So I think I just use different verbology. And it's like, I'm sharing what I do with the public and with people. That's kind of my mentality. And so that helps me get around the whole like consumerist, you know, let's sell a bunch of crap and make money, and all it's about is like making money. I think it's really important that you learn that your art has value, and you've spent time, and you're valuable, because as an artist, you have a really different vision, and you might have a higher conscious level than a lot of people, because you're engaged in the practice of looking all the time and trying to create something from that experience of seeing that most people do not participate in on a daily basis as an artist does. Now, I'm not saying that makes us better than them. It makes us different than them. Artists are not the same as other people, but they need to be able to share that with people and create a value for that special talent that they have. Does that explain it better?
Yeah, well, I think everyone has a perspective on this, so that's why I'm asking yours. Absolutely. Okay. You've got a strong following on Facebook and Twitter. You know, why have you chosen those two mediums to reach your fan base?
Well, it's more Instagram. Instagram is more visual. Because I want to share. I want people to see what's possible. How do I explain this? You have this thing called, in quotation marks, the art world. Art world is run by the status quo. Especially in New York City, art is seen as a commodity. It's seen as something that a lot of people will buy because it's like a stock that will go up in value. So for the artists that are alive that are still making the art, they're not in that special group, like, I mean, let's say Picasso or Jeff Koons or Matisse, that group. And random artists. I'm not like putting Jeff Koons in the same boat as Picasso and Matisse by any stretch of imagination. So there's this thing called the art world. Let's go back to that. And I think that there's a status quo that a lot of people don't want to see that change because of the investment of that work into this modern art, especially in the last 20 years. They don't want to see that crumble because then their stock in that art purchase is going to go down. That's one. Then you have a lot of people in academia as teachers that are not practicing artists, but they're getting paid to be, and I call it tenure art, because the only way that they can make art is because they're on tenure. Somebody else is paying them. They're not selling their product. And then you have a lot of critics that are also like getting paid to write. And a lot of them are not going to step out on a limb and say, hey, this is a new movement. This is amazing, amazing stuff that's coming out. We're going to stick with what works, and we're going to promote the status quo. So you're fighting against a system that is really averse to any sort of resistance to the power that they hold. As an artist, you need to go out. I'm going to go back to the marketing thing. You need to go out and show that there's a different version. There's a different vision that is available and possible. So that's why I use Facebook and I use Instagram, because it shows people that you can make Renaissance quality art of that same sort of high consciousness of spirit that was done 500 years ago, but it's being done today. And so that's how I get high visibility, because somebody else who is not as interested in reading what the critic says or what the academic says or what the gallery says is going to make and form their own opinion by what they see visually. And that's, I think, an amazing way to reach people and create a fan base and a name.
So you actively offer drawing workshops and webinars online. Why have you started those?
Yeah, I taught for 20 years, New York Academy Graduate School, Pennsylvania College of Art, used to be called, that's the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and a few years at the at PAFA, Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. And I was a full-time teacher, but I couldn't get benefits. And I was making, I think back then, it's like maybe 15 years ago, between $35,000 and $40,000 a year. Okay. So you're getting paid $75 an hour. You're working 20 to 22 hours a week. You do the math, and it's not a lot of money, and you can't really do anything when you don't have the finances to support your, like we talked about before, your studio practice. So I thought, all right, what is a good way to advertise what you have? So I went to Facebook and Instagram. I started advertising that I was going to run some webinars. And I started teaching once a week with webinars over the last year and doing the same courses using the same materials that I would teach in graduate school. So here somebody could take a graduate level class in structure and geometry of the figure, which these are high level topics, and then they could watch it in their living room on the screen. They could rewind it. They could play it over 180 times if they wanted to. You could look at the drawings that I was making because I send them to you. I show you the process of how I put a drawing together. I show you my thoughts and how I compose things. Basically, I open my mind up to like anybody who wants to get involved and sign up and register. And I that's just who I am. I'm like, I want to share it with people, and I want to give them, you know, really high value for what they're paying. And that, to me, goes along with the Facebook and the Instagram. It's like you break the system. Don't, if something doesn't work, don't like try to break down the gate and get in there. Go do your own thing and create your own system. And that's what I was talking about earlier in our conversation. It's like, be creative about your business.
So do you talk about the business side of art with your students extensively?
A little bit, not that much. It's funny because I don't consider myself to be so amazing at business, first of all. I'm really a pure, passionate artist with like massive, you know, integrity and mad skills as a sculptor and draftsman. That's who I see myself as. I mean, I do quite well financially, but I don't see myself as this financial guru or wizard. It's just something that I've adopted. And I, believe me, I make plenty of mistakes, but I try to rectify them and I really try to pay attention. I don't talk about it that much. If someday, if they ask me, I might try to help and give a, you know, an honest response, but the answer is no.
Okay, so just a couple of questions for fun to wind down the show. What do you have to say to artists who don't think that they're in business or should need to focus on the business aspects of their art?
Oh, and maybe they don't have to then. I mean, maybe they have a trust fund. Okay, there's a step. There's a process here, okay? You have to have a really high-end product, and it has to be very unique to who you are as a human being. So that's the first thing that you, and you try to do that when you're younger and learn it, and maybe it takes you 10 to 12 years. So let's say you're lucky and you start when you're 18, and by the time you're 30, you got that nailed. The system as it stands is not working for most artists in general. Okay, if you want to have a family and you want to have children and have a home, want to live in a decent part of this country or a decent part of Europe, you need finances. So what are you going to do? You need to get involved. And you're getting involved in your life, not somebody else's life. You're getting involved in taking care of yourself. And this is one of the biggest lessons that I've learned in my life. It's I am responsible for myself. I am where I am at this very instant because I put myself here. If I get in a jam, I am the creator of that jam for the most part. I mean, somebody hits you on the street while you're walking, there are accidents, right? But whatever happens to you for the most part, you are responsible for getting to that place, be it good, be it bad. So you need to take responsibility as an artist for where you stand on all levels, not just in your creative process.
Okay, so from the time you first started to now, if you knew then what you know now and could go back and do one thing over, do it differently, what would it be?
That's the kind of question that I can't answer, honestly, because life is process, and process teaches you how to proceed if you pay attention and you are responsible. So the one thing, perhaps, I mean, I made some very, very large mistakes in my life, and those mistakes, though, led to having to look at myself and make some major changes. So I don't think that, see, because it's like, it's the experience, it's the life experience that taught me. It's like, just to be responsible for where I am. I think that's the biggest thing, to try to look at where I am in my life and say, okay, how did I get here? I created it. That's what I would say. That's the thing that I would have wished that I had known more when I was 20. But you don't carry the same weight and gravitas that you do when you're 53 because of the experience that you passed through. So that's a really tough question.
Well, you know, they asked Thomas Edison, you know, what was it like to fail 200 times in the, you know, on the way to before he created the light bulb? And Thomas said, I didn't fail 200 times. There were 200 steps in the process. So I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly. I guess also there's something that just came to mind. You have to go for it. Don't be afraid to fail. That's what I would have said to myself. If I was looking back at myself and I was having coffee and I was 22, and I was the older self looking at the 22-year-old self, I would say, Sabin, don't be afraid to fail. Don't let fear stand in the way. And I think what happened in my 30s, when I got into rock climbing, I learned this lesson about fear, and that fear can have very damaging effects in terms of reaching your potential if you allow it to. That's the answer that I would give you.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for visual artists. For more information on Sabin Howard, visit sabinhoward.com. And for more information on the Clark Hewlings Fund and our Business Accelerator program, visit clarkhewlingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Sabin. It's been really great having you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.